Okay, I started putting this lesson together at the time when Brother Pike was having some serious difficulty. So I thought if I needed to fill in for him again, I would use this as a two-part lesson. Fortunately, he's doing much better. We're thankful for that. So I thought I'd use the opportunity today, since I had both the Bible study and the lesson, to go ahead and do this. Now, Brother Morris informs me he had an accident this week, a fall, and he's not feeling up to par too much. And I edited a lot of this stuff out of this sermon, so actually, I think it's going to become a three-parter, and I'll do the same topic and do some additional information this evening as well. I hope that it won't be overload. I think that most people find this topic very interesting and informative and educational as well, and I hope that's the case. And I wanted particularly the young people to hear some of this as well. And if you will, as you follow along in your Bible, you might want to make some notes, or you might want to take a separate sheet of paper and make some notes as we go through some of these things. I know that school has only been in session maybe about a month, a little more for some, maybe a little less for others. And the science that is taught in schools today is just so evolutionary, so really anti-God, that I think it's real important for us to look at topics like this, topics about the creation, and try to take a realistic look at the scientific theories that exist and how little proof there is actually of those things. And the lesson that I've prepared takes a little bit different approach than that, because it's looking at scientific facts that are given to us in the Bible that science did not discover for many, many years later. And a lot of these I'm sure you've heard of, maybe all of them you've heard of. But I think it's refreshing for us to look at these and to understand just how awesome God is, the perfect understanding that he has of our universe, and to think the whole time as we look at some of these scientific facts, the idea of the lesson is not to think in today's terms, because we know all that I'm going to talk about is scientific facts today. Our science has discovered those things. But what we want to do is think back at the time that these statements were made. What did science believe at that time? And we'll see quite a different thing then, because science will have considered facts at the time that later were proven wrong by science. So we might start by thinking about what science is. Science really is knowledge. It's the accumulation of knowledge. And if you look in 20 different sources, you will find 20 different definitions of science. But basically, I think the summary of it is science is knowledge. That's almost a synonym for it. But it's knowledge that is accumulated by the observation using our five senses in the present world, using tests, we call experiments, to either affirm or deny hypothesis. And as we repeatedly do those things, we see the same results. We come to various conclusions regarding information. And that becomes part of our knowledge. Of course, if you looked at a science book from when I was in school and compared it to a science book today, you would see astounding differences. You would see tremendous differences, even as we look at our solar system, which we thought we had a real good understanding of when I was in school. But we find many things have changed about that. In fact, one of our planets is no longer a planet. We found out that it doesn't revolve around the sun on a flat plane like the other planets do. And we found out that the sun moves along through space. And we didn't know any of that when I was in school. and that our whole galaxy is moving through space. So we've discovered many different things, and that's what science is. Well, the purpose of the lesson certainly is not to say that the Bible is a science book. The Bible never gives us scientific facts to try to prove that they're scientific facts. In fact, if you think about all the things that we read about the scientific things we read about in the Bible, you'll find that they're used to prove other things or to add emphasis to other things, usually to the power and the majesty and the glory of God. Most of the scientific facts that we'll look at are used to that purpose, to magnify God. And that's what we need to do. That needs to be our attitude. So certainly we're not trying to prove that the Bible is a book of science, although if you use knowledge as a synonym for science, the Bible is a book of knowledge, but it's not a book of scientific fact. The purpose of the lesson is to give us confidence and to give us courage when we stand for the Bible, when we stand for the story of the creation in the Bible, when we talk about the Bible, the world being created in 6 24-hour days. We need to have the courage to stand for those things. And I think this lesson helps us to have that courage because we'll see all the times that the Bible was right and science was wrong. And that's continued to happen. We'll see some of these things thousands of years before science discovered it. The Bible said it. And so we see that during all of these things, that if a man had the position of the Bible, oftentimes he would be thought of as small-minded, that he wasn't intelligent because he believed that statement in the Bible when science knew the facts. And of course, so often those facts are changed later and revised, and ultimately they go back and determine what the Bible said in the first place. And that's the purpose of the lesson. We often are confronted with this statement, science is fact and the Bible is faith. Therefore, whenever science and the Bible contradict, you have to believe science. You can't believe the Bible because science is fact and Bible is faith. Well, how can you make that statement when you see how often the facts of science change? All you have to do is look at it with an open mind, and you see that science constantly revises its facts. And what you wind up with is science is really a belief in what man has done. So in order to really believe everything that science has said, you would have to believe that every experiment was done by a man who is infallible, unbiased, and honest in his observations. Well, in order to believe the Bible, you have to believe that it is written by somebody who is unbiased, infallible, and honest in everything that is said in there. But when I look at those two things, I see they're both faith positions. I don't deny that believing the Bible is a faith position, but so is believing science. And who are you going to put your faith in? Are you going to put your faith in man, or are you going to put your faith in God? The purpose of the lesson is to give us the confidence and the courage to put our faith in God and know that when the Bible and science are different, it's not science that's right, it's the Bible. Every time the Bible is proved to be right. I cannot find one example where science and the Bible disagreed that science wound up being right and the Bible wound up being wrong. But we'll go through many things over the course of these lessons to show us places where the Bible was right and science was wrong. As I said, we're going to be looking at a number of scientific facts that the Bible pointed out years before they were discovered by science. The only way that the Bible could reveal these things to us is if they were a revelation from one who knows everything there is to know about our universe. And that's what I believe. That's the faith position that I take. God, who created this universe, he knows everything about it. And in certain places in the Bible, he revealed facts to us about that universe. And he didn't do it to prove scientific fact. He did it to show us his glory, his majesty, and to show us the nature of the God whom we serve. We're going to begin by looking at the Bible and astronomy. This is some of the most fantastic revelations that are in the Bible, things that we know clearly now and have known for a long time. But the point is, we didn't know them at the time the Bible revealed them to us. So we'll see how that begins to show through as we talk about these things. And again, we need to take ourselves out of our present learning, because these are oftentimes things we take for granted. And we need to understand the thinking at the time these things were written. And then think about how marvelous it is that the Bible revealed these things to us so many years before science discovered. I'm going to begin by looking at the suspension of Earth, Sun, Moon, and stars in space. And that seems very elementary to us, doesn't it? We've known that for a long time. Science has been aware of the fact that there's nothing really holding the Earth in place. But that's not always been the case. There was a time when the common thought was that something had to be holding the Earth up. But Genesis chapter 1, verses 16 and 17 says, God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And he made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. So here we see a revelation how the sun, moon, stars, all the heavenly bodies, the nebula, the globular clusters, the galaxies, everything that's out there, how it got there. God set them in the firmament of heaven. God placed them in space. Placed them there the right distance apart with the right gravitational pulls. Everything they needed to continue the way that he created them. And he reveals that they're just placed there. Well, the earth as well in Job chapter 26 and verse 7. Says he stretched out the north over the empty place and he hangeth the earth upon nothing. Again, we know that today, but can you imagine what a revolutionary thought that was at the time? You see, there was all kinds of thoughts. If we think about when Job was written, Job is one of the oldest books in the Bible. It's not placed at the very beginning of the Bible, but it's one of the oldest books in the Bible. And it's, depending on where you look, anywhere from 3,000 to 4,000 B.C. the book of Job was written. I think probably closer to 4,000 B.C., so it's the oldest, one of the oldest books in the Bible. And Job tells us in about 4,000 B.C. that God hung the earth on nothing. Well, many, many years after that, science had a lot of different ideas. Remember, science is just knowledge. So what did the knowledge of the day say? The knowledge of the day said that in many, many cultures, most of the Indian cultures said that the earth was on the back of turtles or tortoises. And that was a common thought. One, I think, said the tortoise was on the back of an elephant and the earth was on the back of the tortoise, because somebody said, well, what's holding the tortoise there? Well, it must be a big elephant. And so they just continued to revise what they were thinking, right? And if somebody would have said, well, what's holding the elephant up? It would have probably been on the back of a hippopotamus or something. But you see, what would happen is they just had to keep creating a story so that we could explain why the earth was suspended. The indigenous Japanese believed that the world was basically an ocean. The continents floated on the ocean, and the ocean was on the backbone of a trout. And the trout would suck the water in and spew it back out, and that's what caused the tides. So they had a lot figured out with their knowledge of the day. And of course, in Greek mythology, Atlas, because he fell out with Zeus, his burden that he had to bear was to hold the earth up on his shoulders. Now, these weren't revolutionary positions at the time. These were what people believed. That's what people thought. That was their knowledge. That was their science of the day. Well, you remember in Alexandria, remember what was there? The Great Library. And in the Great Library, there was writings found that explained how the earth was held up. It couldn't have been a turtle or an elephant or a trout or anything else. It had to be crystalline spheres or columns that held up the earth. And of course, this is where all the intellects of the day went about 2,200 years ago. So they had figured out that it had to be columns or spheres that held up the earth. It couldn't be an animal, because of course the animal might die or get weak or something else. So it had to be something solid holding the earth up. And that continued to be the thought pattern for a long time. Copernicus in 1475 AD was the first one to really credibly be given attention when he said, "You know what? I think the earth is just hung in the air. I don't think there's anything holding it up." Well, you could write there in Job 26 and 7, Copernicus verified this in 1475 AD. Copernicus verified what the Bible said 5,500 years earlier, that the earth was suspended on nothing. Next, let's think about the vastness of space and the number of stars that there are. And again, to us, we have a pretty good understanding of this. But I'm going to go back to when I was in school, because we didn't yet have the Hubble telescope. And our understanding of space was much different than it is now. In fact, we had a term, the edge of space. That's what they were looking for, where it ended. And we was putting a lot of effort into finding out where space ends. Science has since discovered that space doesn't end. Space is continuously expanding. The universe is continuously expanding. Well, that's a pretty interesting thought, isn't it? Well, let's look in Jeremiah. Jeremiah was written somewhere around 600 B.C. Jeremiah 33 and 22 says, "As the host of heaven cannot be numbered, neither the sand of sea measured, so will I multiply the seed of David, my servant, and the Levites that minister unto me." And you see what I mean? The Bible's not pointing out a fact here. It's not saying, here, I'm going to give you a fact. You can't count the sand on the seashore. You can't count the heavenly bodies. He's saying, he's giving us the fact that that's the way the seed of David is going to be. That's the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham, to the fathers, the patriarchs. But he's saying, just as you can't number the heavenly bodies, just as you can't count the sands of the seashore. Well, that doesn't seem too revolutionary to us, does it? But it's not been that long ago till man thought he could count the stars. It's not that long ago till man definitively determined how many stars there were, because he thought he could see them all. And we'll talk just a little bit more about that in a second. Jeremiah 31 and verse 37. "Thus saith the Lord, if the heavens above can be measured, and the foundations of the earth searched out beneath, I will also cast off the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith the Lord." Again, not to give us a scientific fact, but what this is really saying is you can't measure space. You can't measure the heavens. It's immeasurable. Well, isn't that fascinating that science during my lifetime discovered that you can't measure space because it's ever expanding? The universe is getting larger and larger. Jeremiah said it in 600 AD. We'll have more about the foundations of the earth later. But isn't it just fascinating that as we look at the Bible, we see God saying you can't count the stars. You can't count the sand of the sea. You can't measure the vastness of space. Man has tried to count the stars. It's always been a fascination. And if you look it up on the internet, you'll find that people are still fascinated by how many stars there are. Hipparchus and Ptolemy made a list of all the stars. They definitively counted all the stars. It was 1,056 stars. And they were willing to stake their reputation on that. Well, it wasn't long after that that they began to look through magnifying devices and understanding, wow, there's almost 3,000 stars. during their lifetime, they discovered that, wow, I think there's now 3,000 stars. Well, it wouldn't have took long for Abraham to have 1,056 or even 3,000 descendants, would it? But of course, that wasn't the statement that was being made. It was that there would be millions, there would be countless descendants. And interestingly enough, today, you can't count the descendants. Why? Because many of the records were destroyed in the destruction of Jerusalem in the temple. And those records do not exist. So literally, just as the Bible said, you can't count the number of descendants. Science would argue you could count the descendants of anybody. Science is wrong. The Bible's right. The Bible said you won't be able to count them, and you can't. Abraham lived 3,700 years before the telescope came around. Jeremiah lived 2,200 years before the telescope. This has to show supernatural knowledge, doesn't it? To know that the heavens couldn't be measured, to know that the stars couldn't be counted, when people were actively counting the stars and telling people how many there are. We have a scientific fact, there's 1,056 stars. Well, you see just how wrong science was, don't you? Well, people are still trying to count the stars. The latest estimate that I was able to find was 72 hectillion stars that they believe there is. Well, trillion is a big number. And we hear about that when we hear about our debt and about the amount of money that our government spends. Well, I found this fact, that if you had a military jet plane traveling at the speed of sound, trailing out $1 bills behind it, it would take 14 years to dispense $1 trillion bills, traveling at the speed of sound. That's how big a trillion is. 72 hectillion is 72 billion trillion. That's how many stars they think there is. Now, you think they're accurate? Well, of course not. They're going to continue to count. They're going to continue to find new information. What does the Bible say? You want to know how good God is? You want to know how powerful God is? Psalms 147 and verse 4. Our scientists, the most brilliant minds of the day, with billions of dollars worth of electronic equipment, can't count the stars. Psalms 147 and 4. He telleth the number of stars and calleth them all by their names. That's God versus science. Are you going to put your faith in a man who can't even count the stars? Or are you going to put your faith in a God who knows their names? We couldn't even say 72 hectillion names in our whole lifetime, saying them as fast as we could. God knows them all by their name. The Hubble telescope in 1995 took some images that science called definitive. They could now see the edge of the universe, and the number of stars had maxed out at 7 hectillion. Well, they've discovered 10 times that many now. 1995. The Hubble telescope got real close to figuring out they couldn't be counted. So it's between 1995 and now that man has determined you can't count the stars. Jeremiah told us in 600 BC, you can't count the stars. Sand of the seashores, same thing. There's even more of those, according to the estimates. And how about the uniqueness of the stars? And this is in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians 15:41 says, there is one glory of the sun, and another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars, for one star differeth from another star in glory. And of course, it's talking about the brightness and that. But you think about this. While you can look at the sky and you can see that there's a couple stars brighter than the other, I mean, when you really look at the sky, they all just look like little points of light. And I imagine that nobody at the time of this writing in the first century AD had any idea that some of these stars were so massive, and some of them, like our sun, not so big, even though it looks pretty big to us. But the one star, Betelgeuse, is so big that all of our inner planets can revolve inside the sun. If our sun was in the very center of that star, the five inner planets could all revolve inside that star. I mean, that's just amazing. The Bible talked about all the stars being different from each other. Science wouldn't discover that until the advent of the telescope. 1608, Hans Lippershey invented the telescope. Galileo is usually given the credit for it, but he didn't build one until a year later in 1609. And he was the first to really use it for a study of astronomy. And he started discovering things about heat and magnitude of the stars. And now we have a vast amount of knowledge regarding how different each star is from another star. There are different colors, there are different temperatures, different sizes. We know so much about that 1,500 years later than what the Bible told us. So again, you could say Galileo verified this verse, 1 Corinthians 15:41, 1,500 years later. The uniqueness of the stars. And how about this? The influence of the sun, moon, and planets on the earth. And let's go ahead and look at Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 35 and 36. Thus saith the Lord, which giveth the sun for a light by day, and the ordinances of the moon and of the stars for a light by night, which divideth the sea when the waves thereof roar. The Lord of hosts is his name. If these ordinances depart from before me, saith the Lord, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me forever. Well, I believe that this verse is talking about the tides and how they're influenced by the movements of the moon. If you look at this, it talks about dividing the sea when the waves thereof roar. And it's talking about the ordinances of the moon and the stars and the sun by night and by day. Well, we have two tides, by night and by day. And we have a tide on the east coast of the United States and on the west coast of Europe, for instance. So the Atlantic Ocean is divided and the waves thereof roar into the coast both ways. And we understand at least the tides now being influenced by the movement of the moon. Well, I think probably there's a lot more to it than that. Why? Because Jeremiah said it. And I believe in the end, when we understand even better, we'll see ocean currents and everything being caused by the movement of the heavenly bodies and their influence upon the earth by day and by night. The moon, the sun, and the stars all contributing to the phenomenon of the movement of the ocean. I don't think science yet has that completely figured out. But I think when they do, I know when they do, if they do, it's going to prove that the Bible's right. Jeremiah said it 600 BC. And as we think about the tides, I was actually surprised because it was like 300 BC when somebody first wrote about the influence of the moon, and they had made the correlation between the moon and the tides. And I was surprised by that, because that was something I wouldn't have thought would have taken place many years later. I don't think our understanding was complete in that until many years later. But still, hundreds of years before anybody else had thought of it, the Bible gives us those facts. And I've lost one of my sheets here. Also in this verse, we see the permanence of things in the last part of that. If these ordinances depart from me, saith the Lord. That is, if the laws of motion of the universe is the way I take that because of the previous verse, it's talking about the ordinances of the moon and the stars, their movements in the sky. If those things depart from before me, then the seed of Israel shall cease being a nation before me. Of course, he's saying these ordinances are never going to change. And what is that? That's Newton's first law of motion. Every object in a state of uniform motion tends to remain in that state of motion unless an external force is applied to it. The Bible talks about that. Newton's laws of motion were in 1700. That's probably when our understanding of the tides was getting a lot better. But again, 2300 years later than the Bible talked about it in Jeremiah 31, 35, and 36. Now let's look. We're going to have just a few minutes to get through. I'm going to go ahead and look at one other thing since I'm going to finish all this tonight. One of the things I edited out of here, Job chapter 38 and verse 7. This has to do with astrology still, but it's pretty amazing. When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. We sing the song, "This is my Father's world," and we sing about the music of the spheres. And somebody pointed this out to me. I never really made the connection. But you know, we have discovered with the launch of the SETI program in 1985, the noises of the universe. And it's been described by many as a song. And how amazing is that? Because this word that is used here, R-A-N-A-N, Renan in Hebrew, correlates to a creak or emitting a stridulous sound. So it's not talking maybe about a song as we would think of, but because of the noises and the rhythm, the rhythmic nature of the sounds that the universe make, they're a song. We sing about it in that verse. Job wrote about it in Job 38 and 7, the morning stars singing together. The pulsars were discovered as a result of the SETI program in 1985. Not that many years ago. Of course, they had launched the SETI program, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, spent billions of dollars, which to me says if they're going to find intelligence, they better be looking for it somewhere else. But when they heard the pulsar, they thought, we have found intelligent life. Listen, this rhythmic pulsing. Nothing could randomly produce that sound. It was a song. It was a chant. So they thought they had discovered extraterrestrial intelligence. They found what Job told us about thousands of years ago, the pulsar, the song of the spheres. How amazing is that? The Bible and the atmosphere. And some of this stuff you may not consider atmosphere, but I put it all in here. But the circulation of the atmosphere. In Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 6, it says, "The wind goeth towards the south and turneth about into the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to its circuits." Well, one of the chief things that is used by meteorology today to tell the weather is the circuits of the atmosphere. And this is a recent discovery. This is maybe not within our lifetimes, but certainly within a couple generations, they have discovered and continually learning more about the circuits of the atmosphere. And it helps them understand weather patterns. It helps them understand actually the things of the ocean too, which we'll get to in just a little bit in this lesson. But of course, according to its circuits, indicates its repeated thing. So it's not just random movement of the atmosphere. And I can't remember exactly when I didn't find anything exactly when somebody first said, wow, this is all patterns. But William Farrell and Sir Gilbert Walker and others were writing about it in the mid-1800s. They were starting to understand, wow, there's patterns to that, the winds, and understanding that they repeated and things of that nature. So they started understanding this and using it to start predicting the weather. Of course, they need to learn a lot more to accurately predict the weather, but they have gotten a little bit better at it. Well, what was the thinking at the time? At the time, we can see even in Matthew 16 and 3 that they had a different way of telling the weather at that time. They said, and in the morning it will be foul weather today, for the sky is red and lowering. O ye hypocrites, ye can discern the face of the sky, but ye cannot discern the signs of the times. So we see here that science, the accumulation of knowledge, was looking at the sky even at the time of Christ, understanding a correlation between the sky and the weather. And they would look at the sky and determine what was going to happen with the weather. Well, it took them until the mid-1800s to figure out what we're told in Ecclesiastes, that the weather, the atmosphere, the circuits of the wind have patterns. And they can be used to somewhat reliably predict the weather. So, again, a couple thousand, 3,000 years later, this is verified by William Farrell and Sir Gilbert Walker and others as they begin to study the patterns of the winds and atmospheric fronts and all of those technical things. Well, what about this? Fluid dynamics and the balance of water and air. Again, I saw a reference to this, so I had to go and read a little bit about it. Job 28 and 25 says to make the weight for the winds, and he weigheth the waters by measure. Well, it so happens that one of the critical things to our earth is the amount of water that is here, and the balance of the water vapor that's in the air and the water that's on the ground or in the oceans or wherever it happens to be. And this is something that's very precise. I didn't realize how precise this was, but you can read about that and you can find all kinds of disasters that would happen. If there was a little more water, it would soak up all the carbon dioxide and the plant life would die or something of that nature. And if there was too much water vapor, then there wouldn't be enough oxygen, I think is the way it goes. So the animal life would perish. So it needs to be that good balance that it is. And Job 28 and 25 talks about that, doesn't he? To make the weight for the winds or the air, and he weigheth the waters by measure. He didn't just dump a random amount of water on the earth. There is the amount that's needed in order to preserve his creation. So it was done specifically and for the plant life, human life, sea life, and all could live. In Isaiah 40 and 12, it says, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? So again, we see another reference to the fact that the waters are measured. Now, we might read over these and not think much of them. And God didn't write them for us to understand them as scientific fact. But it's amazing as we read these and we see them and we understand the impact on science today and how important all of these things are. It's just amazing to know that Job told us this 6,000 roughly years ago. That God put the water here and he put just the right amount. He weighed the waters by measure. And Isaiah 40 and 12, he measured it in the hollow of his hand. And just by way of closing up this section of the lesson, the fact that air had weight was scientifically proven in the 1700s. Job, again, one of the oldest books in the Bible, wrote about it in 4000 BC. The relative weights of air and water are needed for the efficient functioning of the world's hydrologic cycle, which sustains life on the earth. It's impossible for them to have known the importance of this with their scientific knowledge at the time. It had to be divine revelation to Isaiah and to Job to write of this that long ago. It's amazing how great and how good is God, how powerful is our Creator. Always proves out to be right when there's a conflict between science and the Bible. Believe the Bible and have the confidence as we use these things. So we'll continue at this point, after we go on with our worship service, we'll pick up. We have a couple more items on the Bible and atmosphere, and I hope everybody finds this stuff as fascinating and as interesting as I do, because I think it's just amazing to see how the Bible revealed these things to us. And hopefully it gives you the confidence to be able to stand for the Bible and to know that when God said God created the heavens and the earth, that's exactly what happened. We'll continue with that thought in a little bit.